This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. The West Bank city of Nablus becomes a flashpoint of tensions, with the Israeli military carrying out a deadly raid into a Palestinian neighborhood. Iranian satellite Hayam is launched into space aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket out of the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Plus, morning rituals are held worldwide on Ashura as Muslims reflect on the lessons of resistance and sacrifice from the historic tragedy of Karbala. Thanks for joining us. Israeli military forces assassinate a Palestinian resistance fighter in a raid on the West Bank city of Nablus. Regime forces surrounded the house of Ibrahim al-Nablusi and launched a rocket toward it. Al-Nablusi was a commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. There was an exchange of fire between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians. At least 30 Palestinians, including a woman, have been injured in the heavy clashes. During the last Israeli attempt to arrest al-Nablusi in late July, clashes broke out between Palestinians and regime soldiers, leaving 2 killed and 9 wounded from gunfire. Another Palestinian child falls victim to the latest Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip. A 10-year-old girl has succumbed to her injuries, which she sustained during the regime's airstrikes on the besieged Palestinian territory last week. Her death raises the number of Palestinians killed in the Israeli aggression to 46. These include 6 children. Another 360 Palestinians were also injured. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad retaliated against the 3-day onslaught, firing hundreds of rockets at Israel. They declared a truce late Sunday. The fighting was triggered by an Israeli strike that assassinated a leader of the Palestinian resistance movement in Gaza on Friday. Continuation of the news that we gave to you in the form of breaking news is related here to 30 Palestinian civilians have been injured when Israeli troops stormed the al-Nablusi home in the old city of Nablus. Al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter, has been assassinated by Israel, of which the storming of his house has led to 30 Palestinian civilians to be injured. Let's see if we can get more on that from our correspondent, Mona Kandil. Mona, at this point, we have a couple pieces of news. One of them is the incident that has happened in Nablus, where 2 resistance fighters have been assassinated. Can you tell us about that if you have information on it, please?
Had been killed by Israeli soldiers during a military raid to Nablus this morning, and the operation has not ended. It's continuing. We are speaking about over 40 Palestinians were wounded, according, of course, to Palestinian paramedics. The main aim of this operation, according to the Israeli military, was the assassination of one of the Palestinian fighters, resistance members, Ibrahim al-Nabulsi. First, the Israelis said after the clashes had been taking place and the Israeli troops surrounded the house of Ibrahim al-Nabulsi in the old town of Nablus, various coming from there were clearly showing Israeli soldiers and clearly the voice of Israeli soldiers demanding and screaming on Ibrahim al-Nabulsi to surrender and to surrender himself, of course, to the Israeli soldiers. But clashes continued to take place. Then Israeli troops pulled out from the old town of Nablus, but the clashes continued. The Israeli media said that Israeli forces succeeded and assassinated Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, but later Palestinian paramedics denied this and said that Ibrahim al-Nabulsi was wounded and he has been transferred to one of the Palestinian hospitals in Nablus. We have to mention that in the last few months, Israeli troops raided Nablus numerous times in order to assassinate Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, whom the Israelis accused that he took part in numerous anti-Israel operations and that he clashed with Israeli troops and fired at Israeli settlers in the last few months. But every time, a number of Palestinians had been killed, but Ibrahim al-Nabulsi succeeded to remain alive and was not assassinated. This time, we cannot, up till the moment, say if he was one of the two who were martyred, or as the Palestinian paramedics are saying, that he was seriously injured and he's in the Palestinian hospitals. The identity of those two who were killed by the Israeli forces is not clear. And the Israeli military, as we are receiving now, are saying that the military operation in Nablus would continue. And if, of course, they are not meant to keep a Palestinian fighter alive and encouraging other Palestinians to follow his footsteps, of course, and to continue to resist the Israeli forces.
When you take a look at the incident that has happened today and add to that what happened days ago where you had Israel targeting the two leaders in the Gaza Strip from the Islamic Jihad, it seems like they are, or they have picked this time to go for targeting these resistance either fighters or leaders. Is there any explanation as to why we are seeing this in a short period of time or span of time where you have Israel targeting these fighters and leaders?
Well, the Israeli troops had always been doing their utmost in order to keep reminding the Palestinians that they are live under occupation and that they don't have the right to fight back the Israeli troops or to continue on the resistance path. But what's going on is clear messages coming, whether from the resistance groups in the Gaza Strip or even here in the occupied West Bank. Dozens of Palestinians had been killed in Nablus and in Jenin. Those who are well known that they are members of the Palestinian resistance groups. They had been fighting back the Israeli forces. This had been angering the Israeli regime, of course. And with the new Israeli regime, every time a new Israeli prime minister is being appointed or a new Israeli cabinet is formed, the first thing they do is to fight Palestinian fighters, to continue imposing more aggressive policies against the Palestinians in order to please the settlers' community and the Israelis in general, and to tell them that it's a strong Israeli regime, it's a strong Israeli prime minister, and they will not allow the Palestinians to fight. This is what's going on now. it's a message to the Palestinian resistance groups that Israel will not allow Palestinians to continue on the path of the struggle or resistance, and it's easy for them to kill Palestinian fighters, Palestinian resistance leaders, as what happens in the Gaza Strip and what's going on in the occupied West Bank, knowing that at the end of the day, none would be holding Israel accountable for its crimes. Because what's going on, and these assassinations, of course, they are crimes, and not allowing Palestinians to fight back, keeping people under occupation without having any none of their rights, is a crime according to the international law.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Monica Ndiol, correspondent there from Ramallah. Moving on, an Iranian satellite is launched into orbit by a Russian Soyuz rocket from the Baikonur space station in Kazakhstan. The satellite, dubbed Khayam, is a remote sensing apparatus that will take high-quality pictures for use in environmental and agricultural research and monitoring of water resources. The Iranian Minister of Communications and Information Technology, Issa Zarapour, says that the launch is the beginning of a strategic cooperation between Tehran and Moscow in the field of space. Russia also put an Iranian satellite into space back in 2005. Iran says the final agreement in the talks to restore the 2015 nuclear deal must guarantee the rights of the country, as well as enduring and effective removal of sanctions. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell after the latest round of talks in Vienna. The top Iranian diplomat said that Tehran has relayed its views and considerations about EU proposals to resolve outstanding issues. Amir Abdollahian pointed to Iran's constructive initiatives in the talks and underscored its seriousness and determination to achieve a deal. He called on the other sides, the U.S. in particular, to adopt a realistic approach and to refrain from unconstructive stances to pave the way to an agreement. Borrell, for his part, says the recent Vienna talks is positive, saying relative progress was made. Earlier, Russia's envoy to the talks said the participants now need to decide if the text submitted by the EU is acceptable.
The EU coordinator circulated the final text of the draft decision on restoration of the JCPOA. The participants in the Vienna talks now need to decide if the draft is acceptable for them. In case of no objection, the nuclear deal will be restored.
The U.S. also says it is ready to quickly conclude a deal based on the EU's proposal. Iran says it is too early to talk about a final text and nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. The nuclear deal known as the JCPOA was derailed after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Indirect talks have been ongoing in Vienna since April of last year for the readmission of the U.S. to the deal and its restoration. Our correspondent in Vienna has interviewed Mohammad Mirandi, an advisor to Iran's negotiating team, about the ongoing talks in the Austrian capital aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. Mirandi touched on some of the remaining issues.
The remaining issues are limited, but they're still very important. For example, the IAEA is an important issue. We have to keep in mind that the IAEA Board of Governors is not a technical body. It's a political body. And it's dominated by Western countries. They have an extraordinarily large amount of influence on the board. And we saw that before the previous board meeting, the IAEA chief went to Israel. So it's not a technical body. For Iran, the issue has to be resolved, the issue between Iran and the IAEA, in a meaningful way. There's also the issue of guarantees. Investors who come to Iran or who want to come to Iran have to feel secure. If the Americans, after 2 months, decide to pull out of the deal, for whatever reason, we have bad experiences with the United States. They're not trustworthy. They're not reliable. So what if the Americans sign a deal and then after a couple of months, they decide to leave? Those investors who entered the Iranian market during that period, are they safe and secure? The Americans initially said no. They said they're on their own. During these months, it gradually went from 0 to 6 months, then to a year, then to 2 years. Right now, I don't want to talk about the final text, but we have a situation that has to be analyzed and decided whether it is enough or not. So you have guarantees, you have the issue of the IAEA, you have the issue of sanctions, what sanctions impede the normalization of the Iranian economy. So all of these have to be discussed in Tehran and in other capitals as a package, and then a response given to the other members of the at the negotiating table.
Iranians have been holding mourning rituals on Ashura, commemoration of the historic Battle of Karbala and its message of resistance against injustice and tyranny. Every year, black-clad mourners mark the occasion with processions or ceremonies to show their grief over the sufferings of Imam Hussein and his companions. Many also converge on religious centers like mosques to commemorate the event. The rituals involve mourners beating on their chests and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Ashura is the 10th day of the Muslim calendar month of Muharram. It is the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred in the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. They were killed by forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid, in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD.
Muslims beating on their chests and shedding tears for a man who was killed some 14 centuries ago. But his heart-wrenching martyrdom continues to touch the hearts of his followers. He is Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. On the day of Ashura, which is the 10th and final day of the annual 10-day mourning rituals, Iranians from all walks of life took part in mass processions across the country to honor Imam Hussein.
Still after 14 centuries, we see that people from any religious and ethnic background participate in Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary. This is because the lessons of Ashura transcend Imam Hussein's time and place, since they're about moral and ethical virtues.
Imam Hussein is a symbol of freedom seeking for all of us, no matter if we are Muslims or non-Muslims. He fought for righteousness and he sacrificed his life and household and this path.
Imam Hussein was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. He was killed along with his 72 companions in a battle against the forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, on the plains of modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala. The Karbala tragedy was sparked after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for he believed that the caliph did not practice true Islam, as taught by the Prophet.
Yazid didn't deserve to rule over Islamic territories since he didn't adhere to Islamic virtues. He was corrupt and cruel, and this is why Imam Hussein didn't pay allegiance to him. In fact, we owe our identity as Muslims to our third Imam.
And this ideology has for centuries been passed on to new generations through such mourning rituals. Here, kids will learn about what Imam Hussein stood for.
I love Imam Hussein. He fought the bad people of his time. So we learn from him that we should never surrender to the bullies.
These people say Imam Hussein's sacrifices saved Islam from distortion and manipulation by Yazid. And this is just one reason why his love never dies down in the hearts of Muslims after 14 centuries. Ashura is the climax of commemoration ceremonies for Imam Hussein. But there's a famous saying among Muslims that goes, every day is Ashura. And this encourages Muslims to live the legacy of Imam Hussein every day in their lives, believing that the messages of Karbala should never be forgotten. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight. Water shortages across the European continent, from France through Italy, Spain and beyond, are creating a critical situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists John Henley, Stephen Bergen, Angela Giuffrida and Philip Alterman. The piece is titled The New Normal: how Europe is being hit by a climate-driven drought crisis. Please stay with us for more. Europe's most severe drought in decades is hitting homes, factories, farmers, and freight across the continent, as experts warn drier winters and searing summers, fueled by global heating, mean water shortages will become the new normal in Europe. The European Union European Drought Observatory has calculated that 45% of the bloc's territory was under drought warning by mid-July, with 15% already on red alert, prompting the European Commission to warn of a critical situation in multiple regions. Conditions have deteriorated since, as repeated heat waves rolled across the European continent. In France, the Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, last week activated a crisis unit to tackle a drought, Meteo France, described as the country's worst since records began in 1958. More than 100 French municipalities have no running drinking water and are being supplied by truck, Green Transition Minister Christophe Béchu said, adding, "We're going to have to get used to episodes of this type. Adaptation is no longer an option, it's an obligation." With surface soil humidity the lowest ever recorded in Europe and July rainfall 85% lower than usual, water restrictions, including hosepipe and irrigation bans, are in place in 93 of France's 96 mainland departments, with 62 classified as in crisis. Amid rising food prices following the Russia-Ukraine conflict, France's agriculture minister warned the corn harvest is likely to be more than 18% lower than last year, while farmers' unions say a shortage of cattle fodder as a result of the drought could lead to significant milk shortages in the coming autumn and winter. The electricity utility, EDF, was last week forced to reduce output from one of its nuclear reactors in southwestern France because of high water temperatures in the Garonne River, and has issued multiple similar warnings for reactors along the Rhone. Spain's water reserves are at an all-time low of 40% and have been falling at a rate of 1.5% a week through a combination of increased consumption and evaporation, according to the Spanish government, in what is likely to be the driest of the past 60 years. The country has received less than half its expected rainfall for the time of year for the past 3 months, with restrictions in place from Catalonia in the northeast to Galicia in the northwest, as well as western Extremadura and Andalusia in the south. Most water restrictions have been imposed on domestic users in Spain, with rural authorities often reluctant to rein in farmers' frequently illegal exploitation of an increasingly scant resource, despite agriculture accounting for 9/10 of Spain's water consumption. A post-pandemic tourism revival has also led to a rise in consumption by as much as 10% in cities such as Barcelona, where, if there is no rainfall soon and none is forecast, restrictions are likely to be imposed next month. Climate change studies warn that droughts are going to be more intense and more frequent and longer, said Nuria Hernandez Moro, the co-founder of the New Water Culture. This is going to be the new normal in Europe, and yet we continue to approve the increased use of a resource we don't have and which is becoming scarcer. This year is also set to become the hottest and driest ever year recorded in Italy. I don't know what we need to do any more to make the climate crisis a political theme, said Luca Mercalli, the president of the Italian Meteorological Society. No similar data in the last 230 years compares with the drought and the heat wave we're experiencing this year. Then we have had storms. These episodes are growing in frequency and intensity, exactly as forecast by climate reports over the last 30 years. Why do we continue to wait to make this a priority? One of the most prominent manifestations of the crisis is the parched River Po in northern Italy. The flow rate of Italy's longest waterway has fallen to one-tenth of the usual figure, while its water level is 2 meters below normal. The Italian government declared a drought emergency in 5 northern regions of Italy, rationing drinking water in early July. Villagers around Lake Maggiore are being supplied by truck. With no sustained rainfall in the region since last November, risotto rice production in the Po Valley, which accounts for about 40% of Italy's agricultural output, is under threat. Growers have warned that up to 60% of the crop may be lost as paddy fields dry out and turn salty, with record low water levels allowing more seawater into the delta. The water crisis is not confined to southern Europe. Water levels have also fallen to dangerous low levels on the Rhine, a vital northwest European waterway used to transport oil, petrol, coal and other raw materials that connects Germany's industrial heartland to the major ports of Rotterdam and Antwerp in the Netherlands. The river's level on Monday, 8th of August, was already lower than at the same point in 2018, when a severe drought eventually halted goods transport for 132 days. Some vessels are operating at 25% capacity to avoid running aground, driving up freight costs. The drought has hit German waterways just as freight vessels are supposed to carry increased amounts of coal in order to service the power plants that the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has reactivated in the face of Russia throttling deliveries of natural gas to Germany. In the capital Berlin, authorities have recorded falling water levels at the many lakes fed by the River Spree. In the southern city of Nuremberg, dried-out urban trees are being watered from municipal indoor swimming pools, closed to save gas. In Switzerland, the dairy industry has been hardest hit. Authorities in Freiburg, Jura and Neuchâtel have had to open valley meadows not usually used for grazing until September, since pastures higher up the mountains were already too dry. Dominique de Boumann, the chairman of Freiburg's cheesemaking cooperative, told Le Temps newspaper that production of cheese and milk was likely to be hit this year. Dominique de Boumann said, "A fall can be predicted and we may even end up with a shortage of Gruyere," he said. In Obwalden canton near Lucerne, the army had to be called in to transport water by helicopter from Lake Sarnen to thirsty cows in the village of Kerns. The Netherlands declared an official water shortage last week. The Dutch government has not yet introduced restrictions on household water consumption, but has asked people to think carefully about whether they need to wash their car or completely fill a paddling pool. In neighbouring Belgium, meanwhile, forecasters reported the driest July since 1885, despite a ban on farmers pumping water for crops, groundwater levels in Flanders are exceptionally low at the moment, causing peatlands to dry out, raising concern about wildlife, including snipe. Canals and rivers are also in bad shape. Local authorities report many fish have died as the only water left in some waterways is industrial or sewage effluent. 13 communities in the Ardennes have banned people from filling their swimming pools. Scientists have said climate breakdown could soon lead to summer droughts becoming more frequent in Western Europe, with extreme heat events that once occurred once a decade happening every 2 or every 3 years, unless governments around the world radically cut their carbon emissions.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we'll be examining the Israeli dungeons of Palestine and look at the way in which debt is wielded to entrap Palestinians deeper into Zionist unfreedom. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. Before that, though, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into the Western companies that profit from the Zionist dungeon system in Palestine.
The Israeli regime currently holds at least 4,450 Palestinians kidnapped in occupation dungeons. Among them are 160 children, 32 women, and 530 people held on administrative detention. Throughout 2021, the Israeli military arrested almost 8,000 Palestinians, including more than 1,300 children and 184 women. This system has generated massive profits for several well-known Western companies over the decades, who seem to have suffered little reputational damage for their role in suppressing the Palestinian people. So, which Western companies have profited and what services do they provide to those dungeons of occupation? US corporation Hewlett-Packard has provided servers, data storage and data security services for the Israeli prison system for the past 7 years. It has also signed deals worth over $1 million to provide similar services for the Israeli police. It has also been essential to the building of a biometric database of Palestinians for Israel occupation forces. Volvo Group, the Swedish multinational manufacturing corporation, is also intimately involved in the Israeli regime dungeons. Volvo and its subsidiary Merkavim provide the buses for the kidnapping and transporting of Palestinians to Israeli prisons. Volvo machinery has also been used in demolitions to aid Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The US company Motorola has also had a very key role in this infrastructure of spatial dominance. It supplies the Israeli police with the Astro 25 communication system through which the officers interact with each other. Motorola Solutions also set up the wide area surveillance system known as Motor Eagle for the Israeli Ministry of Defense. This system is essential to the illegal settlement network and apartheid wall infrastructure. Motorola Solutions even went as far as providing a special encrypted telecommunications system tailor-made for the Israeli military. The Mountain Rose project was designed to prevent the resistance from penetrating Israeli military communications. Motorola has also provided key components for Israeli arms companies like Rafael and Elbit Systems subsidiary IMI Systems. G1 Secure Solutions was previously known as G4S Israel, a subsidiary of the British outsourcing behemoth G4S. The company had over 7,000 workers in the apartheid entity and provides detection systems to the Israeli prison service. It was later contracted to carry out maintenance of the integrated management systems within the Israeli prison system. This included maintaining the CCTV system and control rooms. The company also provided ankle monitors for the jailers to attach to the legs of Palestinians. G4S was campaigned against relentlessly and eventually sold off its Israeli subsidiary. However, it has remained a part of the Israeli police infrastructure through its 25% ownership of the Policity Corporation. Policity trains Israeli police officers on a plethora of suppressive measures, from crowd control to interrogation techniques and undercover operations. Just as G4S was pressured to sell the Israeli subsidiary engaged in this work, so too must be the other Western companies party to the crimes of the Israeli regime.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Sham Murad. Sham is an Iraqi academic and legal researcher based in Birmingham in the UK. She's a co-founder of the A is for Activism group, and she's been described as Baghdad's finest and Birmingham's own. Sham joins us today by Skype. Welcome to the show. Sham, let me start with you. You've said in the past that Palestine is not negotiable. I wonder if you could tell us what do you mean by that?
Thank you for having me on the show, Chris. One of the regular demands that we hear expressed by imperialist politicians and media is for Palestinians to sit at a table with Zionist colonizers and Western imperialists and negotiate away their land and their rights under the facade of a peace process. So when we say Palestine is not negotiable, we are rejecting the demand for them to engage in talks to carve out how much land that the Zionists are allowed to colonize and under what conditions Palestinians are allowed to live on their land. Palestinians have been clear since before the Nakba of 1948 that Palestine from the river to the sea belongs to the Palestinians and that they will not waver in their struggle for total liberation from colonialism and imperialism. No colonized people have acquired their land and freedom through negotiations with their colonizer. Palestinians have an inalienable right to fight for their land and for their freedom, a victory that will not happen through what Palestinian revolutionary Hassan Kanafani calls a conversation between the neck and the sword. For Kanafani, negotiations are not talks, but rather a form of capitulation. And that path is that one that the Palestinian masses reject en masse. Additionally, we also see this demand on the Western left for movements here to ignore the questions of colonialism and imperialism, or to put these questions to the side. So when we say Palestine is not negotiable, we also mean we reject the idea that of the Western left that advances progressive values on many issues, but refuses to take a principled anti-imperialist position pertaining to the global south, and particularly with regards to Palestine. The sheer arrogant expectation that Palestinians should accept anything less than what they had before 1948 is not negotiable. So a mass workers and people's movement in the West must be willing to fight for the liberation of all peoples against imperialism. And that, of course, includes the Palestinian people.
Indeed. Well, thank you. I mean, David, tell us a bit about the other US corporations that are invested in the Zionist colonization of Palestine. And what about the British corporations today and, for that matter, in the past as well?
Well, I mean, one that comes to mind is Airbnb, which, of course, was pressured to remove its listings in settlements and then reversed itself and allowed the listings. They're still listed. You can still go and live in illegal settlements with settlers. And it said, by way of compensation, that it would give the money that it made from these illegal settlements to humanitarian groups, which, of course, is a way around the fact that they're collaborating directly with the illegal settlements. In the UK, I mean, I suppose the most famous one is Marks and Spencer's, which, as we've heard in this programme before, set up a recruitment center for the Haganah, the terrorist force which established the State of Israel back in 1947-48. And all the way through this process since 1948, Marks and Spencers, the families associated with Marks and Spencers, have been huge contributors to Zazim and indeed to activities in illegal settlements. So there's been, those are two examples, but there are more, where the business interests of Zionist leaders in this country and in the US have actually pumped millions of pounds into illegal activities in the settlements and indeed into ethnic cleansing in Palestine.
Mm. I mean, Cham, the previous report detailed significant corporate profiteering from Israeli prisons in Palestine. I mean, how do you think that connects to the struggles in countries like the US and Britain, where some of those corporations actually originate?
Yes, in Palestine, much like the US and Britain, prisons are used as a tool to oppress, colonize and exploit people. Leaders of anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements are incarcerated by a prison industrial complex that seeks not only to repress mass movements, but also exploit prisoners and profit of incarceration, off of incarceration. So we see the incarceration of revolutionary leaders like Moumaya Abu-Jamal in the US, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah in France, and Ahmed Sadat in Palestine by the Zionist entity. The law that political prisoners have all dared to break is the law of capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism. We also see, much similarly, surveillance corporations reaping profits from the repression and incarceration of colonized peoples, and know that Israel, the US, and other countries such as Canada and Britain exchange surveillance technology and policing tactics. This is seen through the collaboration between US police and Zionist military, the Canadian RCMP and the Zionist military units, and similarly the British police and the same training that they have received from Zionist military units. We know that a large amount of police and military technology that are used by British and American police are in prisons in the West, are tested on Palestinians by the Zionist entity. So it's important for us to continuously identify the relationship between the corporations and prisons and military, as these help us to then connect capitalism to imperialism and colonialism. We know that these are British corporations who benefit from prisons, both here and in places like Palestine. And it is pivotal for our activism here to be able to target these corporations that are complicit in the incarceration of colonized people fighting against imperialism and capitalism, including our comrades in Palestine.
Yes. I mean, David, I understand that HSBC previously divested from Israeli arms companies before, but how successful do you think have other pressure campaigns been in the past?
Well, I mean, these pressure campaigns can sometimes work, but it's not really very clear how effective they are and whether the results of the HSBC action did mean they had fully divested. So, you know, really the model we have to follow, I think, is the model pursued by Palestine Action, for example, in this country, of direct action. It's only through doing direct action like this that companies can be forced into facing the activities that they're complicit in and forced into actually withdrawing from them in a more sort of actually genuine way. So I think really, that, you know, the lesson is that the direct action is the way forward for these kinds of campaigns.
Yeah. Cham, tell us a bit about the relationship between neoliberalism and the privatisation of prisons.
Yes. In the 1980s, with the forced project of neoliberalism, which was spread both abroad through the imperialism like we saw in Chile and the unfortunate death of Salvador Allende, and at home through the state policies of key figures like Thatcher and Reagan, we saw the privatization of prisons as well as the shifting of funds from welfare services towards the military and police. This era saw the expansion of prisons, huge increases in numbers of the people incarcerated, which were primarily poor and racialized people. We also saw, with the expansion of prisons is the expansion of prison labor and the privatization either of prisons themselves or elements of incarceration through public to private partnership. And it is through neoliberalism that the state offered new incentives for an increase in incarceration, meaning incarceration is not only as a tool for repression, but also as a tool for profit. As we saw, neoliberalism rolled back funding for things such as social housing and welfare. It rolled out funding for the punitive arms of the state, such as the police, who were tasked with incarcerating those in precarious positions who had now lost the limited social welfare that they had and housing that they had. Thus, neoliberalism, through the reallocation of funds, incentivized and allocated budgets towards punishing people and incarcerating those who had been made poor by capitalism. Interestingly enough, Frantz Fanon once wrote that in the colonies, it is the policeman and the soldier who are the official instituted go-betweens, the spokesman of the settler and his rule of oppression. And we see that through decades of industrialization, racial discrimination in housing and employment, and growing income inequality that have created pockets of intense poverty where jobs are scarce, public services are inadequate, and crime and violence are even more widespread. And even with the more intensive over-policing that we see today, people still feel unsafe, and young people continue to use violence as a predation and protection.
Indeed.
Any program
for... Yeah, you'll just need to just pause there for a moment, if we can, Sian. Thanks for that. Because we want to just have a look at this report on some of the cruel practices that are being used in Zionist prisons.
As we've seen, the Israeli prison system is a profit-churning factory of unfreedom for thousands of Palestinians. The profits are generated by Western and Israeli companies alike, but there's also a sophisticated system whereby the Israeli regime extracts profit from Palestinian prisoners by ensnaring them into debt for a myriad of whimsical reasons. Palestinian prisoners can be fined for missing the morning count, for returning their food plates to the jailers late. They can be fined to compensate for damage to property caused when Zionist guards beat them inside the jail. They can be fined for refusing to be strip searched or for protesting against the conditions within the facilities. According to Euromed Human Rights Monitor, in 2016 alone, it was found that overall fines of prisoners added up to an average of $500,000 per inmate. The Human Rights Watchdog commented that the imposition of financial fines on Palestinian prisoners has become a consistent approach adopted by the Israeli judiciary, where almost no sentence is passed without a fine. The next year, in 2017, found minors in Israeli prisons fined around $11,000 in 1 month alone. There are numerous examples, like the Alawi family in Nablus, who were forced to sell their home to pay off Israeli prison fines, with the threat of more jail time if the debt was not paid. There's also the case of Palestine's oldest female prisoner, Saadia Farajalla, who died just days after attending Israeli military court in a wheelchair and being told that she must pay 15,000 shekels worth of fines. The debt trap in Israeli prisons is real and a tool of economic warfare against Palestinians.
David, what about this despicable policy of using debt to ensnare Palestinian families while they're in prison? I mean, it's kind of beyond the pale. I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as you saw in the film there, the amount of money on average that young Palestinian prisoners are fined is about £125,000, right, in British money, that is. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the cost of two houses in the West Bank, on average. So that's a huge burden of debt which every Palestinian prisoner is saddled with, and of course their families have to pay. And so it's a way of really immiserating even further the occupied people in the West Bank. It's extraordinary.
You're not kidding. It really is. Sian, you're involved, aren't you, in Palestine Action, in that movement? And what just say a little bit about what the connection is between that activism and the plight of Palestinian prisoners.
Yes, Palestine Action is an incredible direct action organisation that has targeted Albert locations across the UK, aimed with shutting them down. Albert Systems is an Israeli arms company that tests its weapon on Palestinians and whose weapons have been used to repress, kill and incarcerate Palestinians. Albert Systems weapons have been directly used to facilitate Zionist raids, which have resulted in the arrest of the thousands of Palestinians. And it's the work of PalAction that they do in targeting these factories and directly challenging the ability of the Zionist state to arrest Palestinians. Additionally, a large portion of Albert's profits come from the Zionist military. Through shutting down their factories, PalAction is directly challenging the profits of Albert, which are directly extracting the from the colonization and occupation of the Palestinian people. It's important to also note that this work challenges not only the repression of Palestinians, but of prisoners and colonized people around the world, as Albert has contracts and deals to sell weaponry to nations across the world, including US and England. Thus, the work of PALACTION also threatens the global imperialist alliance rather than just that in Israel alone, and the profiteering made by colonialism and capitalism, and directly threatens the repression of colonized and exploited people across the world by Albert's weaponry.
Yeah. I mean, David, what kind of pressure do you think could be applied on companies that are profiteering from the ethnic cleansing of Palestine?
Well, I think, as we've heard, I mean, the kind of pressure that's needed is that people need to directly target these companies. Mm. They need to have direct action. They need to have protests outside on a repeat basis. And some of the tactics that have been used by Palestine Action have been extraordinary. They've had an alliance with the local community. They've had support from the local trade union movement, in particular the fire brigade union. Indeed. And they've also engaged in direct action where they've deliberately damaged the factories where these arms are made. And not one of them has been found guilty of any kind of crime as a result of this. And this is a model which we need to follow for, I think, many other companies which are engaged in these really inhumane and appalling acts in occupied Palestine.
Mm. Sham, I mean, companies like Volvo, Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, they're deeply invested in the infrastructure of the occupation, aren't they? I mean, what do you think can be done to challenge them?
Yeah, there's a number of ways we can challenge these companies. Firstly, boycotts, divestment and sanctions, the role of campaigns which directly tackle the ability of these companies to be profitable and forcing their hand to change. Secondly, through direct action campaigns, which can target the factories and businesses of these companies. We see how overwhelmingly successful it has been with Palestine Action. But also just last year, we saw South African dock workers refuse to unload Israeli ships in solidarity with Palestinians. And this is the kind of action that can be necessary to force change. And thirdly, I think it's quintessential to broader struggles that seek to challenge capitalism, imperialism and colonialism, and understand that the role that corporations have in the global imperialist system, and thus not expecting them to be part of the solution, but rather organizing broadly against capitalism and neoliberalism, and understand the role it plays in the repression of all people.
Yeah, I mean, you have got a book club, haven't you, in Birmingham, Sham? I mean, I just wondered if you could tell us a bit about how you've kind of brought in the issue of Palestine and neoliberalism into that space.
Yes, absolutely. The very first text we studied in 2017 was Angela Davis's Freedom is a Constant Struggle. And there was many reasons for this. Part of it was to see how our struggles interlock with one another, because Angela Davis drew incredible distinctions between Palestine freedom movements and how they are crushed, and the Palestinian liberation and black liberation movements, especially in the context of Ferguson. And even more interestingly, as we studied this text many years ago, and we've seen G4S now have their hands forced, she drew comparisons on how G4S uses its company to maintain and reproduce the repressive apparatus in Palestine, be it their prisons or their checkpoints. But also she drew the comparisons on how G4S is also used to deport Mexican detainees in America, and also what we had seen in the UK itself with Jimmy Mbenga's deportation, and it was G4S agents and guards that had killed him. So it's this idea that G4S represents this growing insistence on what is called security under the neoliberal state, and ideologies of security that bolster not only the privatization of security and then privatization of imprisonment and the privatization of warfare, but just in general making it a more dangerous world for colonized and exploited people.
Yes. I mean, David, there's around 500 to 700 Palestinian kids imprisoned every single year, and mainly for things like stone throwing, and they can face sentences of up to 20 years. I mean, what kind of treatments are these Palestinian youngsters being subjected to in these dungeons, these Zionist prisons?
It won't surprise you to learn, Chris, that the treatment is not good. I mean, there's all sorts of mistreatment of prisoners, direct violence against them, torture, and all sorts of harassment of them, and the fine system where they're fined for doing things which they haven't themselves done. Yeah. So when they get beaten up, they get fined for that. But so the damage caused by the guards beating them up, they get fined for that. So there's all sorts of ways in which they are oppressed and repressed every day that they are in there. It's extraordinary, and hardly anyone hears about it. But, you know, we've been able to talk about it today, and hopefully this is the beginning of people saying, look, this is not acceptable, this has to stop.
Well, I hope it certainly is a beginning, David, because, I mean, we've got a situation here where, you know, in South Africa, the apartheid system was held to account by the corporate media, but they are, you know, the silence is deafening, it seems to me, when it comes to the abuses of these Zionist gangsters. But unfortunately, I can't ask for a response on that, David, because we are absolutely out of time, and so we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, and thank you to Sham, obviously, for joining us via Skype, and thanks to David again. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
If Donald Trump or any of the likely U.S. Republican nominees win in 2024 presidential election, they will immediately move to protect those who attempted to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Lawrence Tribe and Dennis Aftergut. The piece is titled, Time is Running Out,